Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. And this week in 1996, this story about what happened at Brookfield Zoo was all over the news, wasn't it, Anna?
You know, it captured captured the attention of everyone. And if you go back and think about it, you can see why. Brookfield Zoo was the scene of what could have been a major tragedy, Bob, but luckily wasn't. The date was August 16th, 1996. This beautiful day, lots of families were out at Tropic World, which was one of the big zoo attractions at the time. And back then, the kids could press against the railing and watch the western lowland gorillas below. It was this really kind of cool interactive thing. There was this huge moat, so it was supposedly safe. But what happened was a three-year-old boy slips away from his mother, as we all recall, ran across the barrier, tumbled down into the gorilla enclosure, and he hit the concrete hard. The crowd was just panicked. Everybody was frantic. What do you do? There were seven gorillas in that enclosure and this three-year-old boy kind of lifeless in the middle of it. And so everyone was kind of bracing to see, you know, what's going to happen here? What do we do? Until an eight-year-old female gorilla, and this was so remarkable. I remember it like it was yesterday. She had a 17-month-old baby clinging to her back, her own baby, and she walked straight over to the injured child. She fends off another gorilla who was trying to make a move in that direction. She scoops up the injured toddler. She cradles him against her chest, and then she carries him over to the service door where the zookeepers, you know, serve meals and stuff, and then just laid him down very gently there so that the paramedics and zookeepers could just scoop him up, get him. Just a remarkable story from the animal world that captured the hearts and minds of just everybody in Chicago at that time, as you'll recall, Bob. We pulled a clip from WGN TV News that night's reporting on what happened that remarkable day at Brookfield Zoo.
That is quite an animal story. Mm-hmm. And the boy made a complete recovery, right?
You know, it's interesting because he was looked pretty lifeless at the time, Bob. I remember the videos the people had shot at the scene. He just had a broken hand. He had a head injury. But like 4 days later after his hospital visit, he was fine, made a complete and total recovery. Just a really awesome story.
Now, let's go back to this week in 1967. It's hard to believe that when Picasso's masterpiece sculpture was unveiled in Daley Plaza, folks were horrified. They were shocked. We're used to it now, but back then, not so much.
Totally used to it now. It's just, you know, it's our art, right? It's our city's art. But back then, Bob, it was horrifying. And so go back to this week, 1967, when the masterpiece from Pablo Picasso himself was unveiled in Daley Plaza by Mayor Daley. It was like an invasion from Mars had happened when people saw this like bizarre 160-ton steel creature that had been dropped in the middle of our city. People like, what is that? Is that a bird? Is that a baboon? No one knew. And the TV and radio reports played back Chicagoans' reactions, and they were not pretty. People said things like, it's hideous, it's scary. One woman said, it's like a cow sticking out its tongue at Chicago. Mayor Daley, this is very interesting. I know you and I love studying his history and just what the impact on the city, but he said in his speech, what is strange to us today will be familiar tomorrow. Kind of interesting. 50,000 people were there. Gwendolyn Brooks was there, all kinds of dignitaries. And he pulled the cord, revealed this, you know, thing. And then we pulled a great clip for you here, Bob. Mayor Richard J. Daley after the unveiling of the Picasso in 1967.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it's a great thing. 1967. That's great.
Yeah. Pablo Picasso himself, by the way, said it was inspired by his Afghan hound, though art critics swore it also resembled his ex-wife. So I don't know. We don't need to make sense of it. 60 years later, here we are, and it's just there. It's our thing.
Well, this week in 2003, something that when you hear it is still truly horrifying, Ozzy Osbourne singing at Wrigley Field.
It's hard to get the worst award when you've got a few candidates. I heard you mention before, you got the Mike Ditka rendition, the Mr. T, which was kind of lovely, even though it wasn't the perfect words. But the Cubs fans will always remember this one, I think. 23 years ago this week, Ozzy Osbourne, only slightly helped by his wife Sharon, who thought to bring the words on a piece of paper because neither of them knew the words. And they were just going through the whole thing before thousands of Cubs fans. I don't think they ran through it once, ever. Like, I don't think they obviously didn't know the song, and that's okay. They're from England. But the way it came out, Bob, you know, it just wasn't pretty. Ozzy opened with, like, I think, Let's Go Out to the Ball Game, and it was just downhill from there. even like players like Kerry Wood came out of the dugout, if you recall, to look up at the booth and go, what is going on? This is like a slow motion train wreck. Here, it's just a reminder, we have pulled the sound so you can recall what that sounded like when Ozzie did it.
I kind of like that one now that I hear it again.
I think it sounds worse than I recall every time
okay.
I hear it.
All right.
But he's so loved. Everyone loves Ozzy. I loved Ozzy, you know, the late Ozzy Osbourne. So we, you know, there was big hearts for that moment, but just a butchering of the song for sure. Vin Scully gave it a thumbs up, by the way. He was there at the time. So he's got that going for him.
Yeah, always the gentleman, Vin Scully. Oh, yeah. One of the many acts on Soul Train. And it all started in Chicago, didn't it, Anna?
Right here, 1970, Bob hit the local airwaves, Soul Train, broadcasting from a tiny studio inside the Chicago Board of Trade building. Don Cornelius, the legendary visionary behind it all, he said he couldn't afford anything more than this tiny, tiny studio. He couldn't even afford color cameras when he started. But Soul Train, when it aired on WCIU in Channel 26 in Chicago, it was a huge hit pretty much from the moment it launched. He was such a visionary, if you think about it. Chicago native, came from his, you know, local radio history. He was a DJ. And he wanted a show. He wanted to create a show that looked like the kids he saw every day. He, you know, American Bandstand was big, and it featured middle America. But Soul Train put minorities in the limelight, featuring, you know, minorities dancers, but also supporting Motown talent and giving a big stage to some of these upcoming rising minority talent or others that maybe just didn't really fit the mold of American Bandstand. You had Earth, Wind & Fire, Jackson 5, Barry White, Run DMC, even Elton John appeared on Soul Train back in the day. Years later, after multiple Emmys, Bob, and lots of awards and respect, Don Cornelius returned to Chicago to appear at the Museum of Broadcast Communications to talk about his start here in the city.
What a voice. I always feel like Barney Pipp talking after listening to Don Cornelius.
Just an incredible talent in so many ways, you know, and think about what he did. And then moved to L.A., of course, Bob, as you know, but for the syndication, for the national syndication. But mm-hmm. It starts right here.
And lately, we've been talking a lot about the anniversary of the first night game at Wrigley Field. But you don't hear a lot about the very first Major League night game ever. And that was played right here in Chicago.
Right here in Chicago, Bob. What's far less remembered is that Chicago moment in history. The very first Major League Baseball night game with lights ever was played in Chicago on the south side at Comiskey. The date was August 14th, 1939 at exactly 8:25 p.m. A young Charles Comiskey II walked over to the switches in the office that was occupied by his late father, and he flipped on the lights. Instantly, this $140,000 system turned on. Think about that price tag. But a Cubs executives were in the stands that night, and including a young Bill Veeck. And he was president of Cubs, of course. He wanted to watch carefully at what was happening here and take it all in. And he was asked later, when will Wrigley get lights? And he said, when the fans want them. Well, it took half a century, Bob, as you know. We waited a long time from that point forward for a lot of different reasons, but Wrigley eventually did get lights. Interesting to remember the history, though, of mm-hmm. that very first game, Major League Baseball.
Finally, when you're stopped at a red light today, think about this. 1912.
The very first traffic light, Bob, installed on Michigan Avenue, developed by a Chicago engineer who was granted a U.S. patent for a street traffic system. They had no red light, no green light back then. They just had these illuminated arms, and it would say stop or proceed. And that's what you saw. By 1923, though, they put a whole series of them in, financed by the cab companies who wanted order on the streets. Went back and look at the records. There were 30,000 cars in the city in the early 20s, 2,000 trucks, a few hundred buses, and there still were 1,400 horse-drawn wagons. So you had a lot of activity out there, and the street lights, the traffic lights, just really brought some order to everything. So now we got that all sorted out. We have total order on Chicago streets.
Where have you been
all
driving?
Sorted out.
Thanks, Anna. Talk to you next week.